My guest today, journalist Reese Ehrlich, a native Californian, has been a friend since the 60s when we were both active in the anti-Vietnam War movement in the Bay Area. In October 1967, Reese and a half dozen other activists organized Stop the Draft Week, which shut down downtown Oakland for a week and was probably the most successful protest against the Vietnam War across the country. They were all arrested, became known as the Oakland Seven, and in their trial, thanks to the defense of lawyer Charles Gary, they were acquitted of all charges. In 1968, Reese visited Cuba for the first time, which led to a continuing interest in that country that would eventually lead to a book called Dateline Havana in 2009, which I interviewed him about at that time. He also worked earlier as a staff reporter and research editor for Ramparts, the most important investigating and reporting magazine in the 60s and 70s, and more recently his articles have appeared in Mother Jones, The Progressive, and The Nation. Reese's book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, co-authored with Norman Solomon, now a candidate for Congress in this district, became a bestseller in 2003. Another book, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, was published in 2007. And more recently, he received a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting for his reporting on Syria, which most recently appeared in an article in the December-January issue of the Progressive magazine, still on the newsstands, which caught my eye, entitled You Can't Believe the Violence. Welcome once again, Reese Ehrlich, to Takes on the World.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you back. The last time I had you as a guest was to speak about your book on Cuba. It was the first and only program I have done on Cuba, since it's difficult to find a journalist who doesn't take a one-sided view on the subject. That problem's even worse when it comes to Syria, where depending on what one reads or listens to, the competing scenarios are even wider apart. In one, the mainstream media version, a repressive dictator, Bashar al-Assad, is suppressing a democratic movement calling for regime change. And on another, what we are seeing is the latest attempt by the U.S., Israel, and their European and Arab allies to overthrow a government that stands in their way, and that those protesting al-Assad are at best their pawns. From what I've been able to tell, there is some truth in both scenarios, but there's no denying that the protest against the al-Assad regime began as a legitimate expression of a significant part of the Syrian population, which was inspired by the events in Tunisia and Egypt. You were on the ground in Syria in October and had a chance to speak with some of those protesters and wrote about it in The Progressive. So tell us how you see it.
Yeah, as your listeners know, it's very difficult to get into Syria these days as a reporter. Actually, just this morning, a French reporter was killed while touring in Homs. It's dangerous, and the government has been very reluctant to allow in reporters, but I did manage to get an official visa. I was there for a week, and I had a chance to go to three different cities, and I was not followed around. I had a minder with me part of the time, but most of the time I was free to do my reporting as I normally would. And I agree with your analysis. That is, Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian government have taken stands legitimate stance, demanding the return of the Golan Heights. They've supported Palestinians, although we can question about some of the political decisions with that. But people also forget that the Syrian government sided with the U.S. during the Gulf War in 1990. It cooperated with the U.S. in torturing alleged terrorists that were shipped to them by the CIA. And not to mention very serious repression of Kurdish people and others inside Syria itself. So Bashar al-Assad is certainly no great hero or anti-imperialist icon. He's an Arab dictator who at times has sided with the U.S. and is at times not. And the key thing about the uprising is that it was a spontaneous uprising by the people, by widespread numbers of people in Syria, against a very repressive regime. And that's the bottom line.
Now, this uprising began in the south of Daraa, near Jordan, and in the outskirts, outside of the main cities of Damascus and Aleppo. Now, it seems, we haven't heard much from Aleppo, but we have had now protests in Damascus. But how does the protest break down? Because you've also written about the minorities in Syria, which the Assad regime has managed to protect and also bring to his side, such as the Christians and, of course, the Alawites, which he's an Alawite, which is a small part of the Shia religion. So how does the protest break down in this sense?
There's no question that the government has popular support in Damascus and Aleppo, which is the two largest cities. They have considerable support. The big business community, which is, you've got a system of crony capitalism, not unlike what you had in Egypt and Tunisia and other places. And that class of people remains strongly supportive of the government. And in addition, the Christians and the Alawites, and to a lesser extent, the Kurds, who are a separate ethnic group, believe the government's media saying that Muslim extremists are in charge of the opposition. And if they come to power, they're going to attack and drive Christians and kill them or drive them out of the country. And that what the real goal of the U.S., which is behind the uprising, is to turn Syria into another Iraq, where you had a former a dictatorship, but it was a secular dictatorship, is now run by a religious dictatorship. And so they say that the same thing is going to happen in Syria. And there are significant numbers of Alawites and Christians who believe that. There's also Alawites and Christians and Kurds who are part of the opposition demonstrating out in the streets.
Now, we keep hearing almost in every country where it exists about the Muslim Brotherhood, and which goes back many years, and it was like a mysterious organization the way it's described in the West, and it's evolved over a number of years and functioned in different ways, and Hamas was reportedly in Palestine connected to, from the very beginning, to the Muslim Brotherhood. In Egypt, we now hear that the U.S. government is ready to work with the Muslim Brotherhood, which seems to be the most popular party going to winning the elections there. What was the attitude that you found, people you spoke with? Did you speak with any people with the Muslim Brotherhood when you were there?
Sure. I spoke to supporters and analysts. There's no question that the Muslim Brotherhood, in its origins, was a very conservative Islamic party who adhered to a kind of a fundamentalist interpretation of Islam and a very conservative interpretation of what kind of government they want. But they've changed, and you can see that in Hamas in Palestine, who indeed was an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood when it was formed. But the reality of governing has changed Hamas. They simply don't hold to many of the old positions. We saw that in Egypt, where the younger members of Muslim Brotherhood, when actually out in the streets working with secular people and others and Christians, they began to change it. And the same thing is happening in Syria. The Muslim Brotherhood has evolved, and similar parties in Syria have evolved to basically wanting a more or less what they have in Turkey, where there's a moderate Islamist party that won elections, that adheres to the rules, if you will, but still gains inspiration from Islam for their politics. We have that with Christian Democrat parties all over the world, where they're Christian parties, but they govern. The key question is, would they participate in a democratic electoral system, and would they play by the rules?
Now, one of the key aspects of what's going on there, the Muslim Brotherhood is Sunni, and it is the Sunnis are the majority in Syria. One of the most key aspects of the Syrian foreign policy is its link on one side to Iran and to its support for Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has put Hezbollah in a very difficult position, because even though the Lebanon society is much more open and free than Syria's has ever been, Hezbollah has felt obligated to come to the support of the Assad regime, which has backed him up, much like Castro supported the intervention of the Russians into Czechoslovakia. Was there much discussion when you were in the possibility with Assad being overthrown, that this situation and the attitude toward Hezbollah from the Syria would change dramatically? Was this much discussed when you were in Syria?
Yes. So a little bit of background. Hezbollah is a overwhelmingly Shia Muslim organization in Lebanon that is both a militia and a political party in Lebanon. and they have received a lot of support from Iran and secondarily from Syria. Their ties with Iran are ideological and religious. You can go to, I've been in Hezbollah-controlled areas of Lebanon in the south of the country, and you see huge posters of Ayatollah Khomeini right next to Sheikh Nasrallah, who is the head of Hezbollah. And so, and you don't even see that in Iran. You don't see the huge the number of posters of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran anymore. So ideologically, they feel very close. The alliance with Syria is much more political because, as I mentioned, Assad is a secular dictator. He's not religious. He considers himself a pan-Arabist, and he. But they find themselves on the same side of things and support one another, and Iranian arms come through Syria, for example, on their way to Lebanon. The people inside Syria, a lot of people, it's hard to know long-term, but of course there's some resentment. Anybody who supports the people that you're fighting against, you get mad at them. Interestingly enough, Hamas, which also receives support from Syria, has been much more critical of Assad. In fact, they're probably in the process of moving their headquarters out of Damascus. They've been much more critical and supportive of the people of Syria. So it's a mixed bag. And in any case, the whoever comes to power in Syria through a democratic process is going to make alliances with Lebanon, have ties with Lebanon, and support for the Palestinians, and have conflicts with Israel. That's the nature of the beast as long as Israel continues to occupy Syrian land and the Golan. So I don't think we're going to see, there may be tinkering around the edges, but we're not going to see huge shifts in Syrian foreign policy, whoever comes to power.
I guess as Reese Ehrlich, we're talking about Syria where he recently visited. There, of course, is talk and of whether or not there should be or will be a Libyan-style intervention by the U.S. and NATO in Syria, which seems to be encouraged by some call it the Syrian National Council, Syrians outside of Syria. But from your article, it would appear that those actually on the ground do not look forward or want that kind of intervention.
Absolutely, and even the Syrian National Council has not come out against foreign intervention. That's how
you mean, you mean for it?
No, against foreign intervention.
It has come out against it.
Yeah, recently, within the last week or so. And it's a reflection of the very strong pressure from inside Syria. The leaders I talked to were unanimous in opposing foreign intervention. There's no question that there was some sentiment for it, both inside and outside. And, of course, the sectors of the Europeans and the U.S. ruling elite would love to see foreign intervention like happened in Libya, because that gives them the leverage then to install a government that's pro-Western. But the folks in Syria are not so stupid. They realize that if you get a foreign intervention, military intervention in particular, you get the government then that cut power wants. And people who criticize that I interviewed, these were leaders that I had a chance to interview inside Syria, were very critical of the West and its dealings with Libya. They know now that the West is going to install a pro-Western dictatorship, and it's going to be a continued struggle there, and they're not interested in having that with Syria. So as difficult as it is, and as repressive as the government is, they feel that with time they can get rid of their own government and install a democratic one.
Now, Hafez al-Assad seems not to get the message, and whether he's being pushed by his younger, tougher brother or not. He just made a speech yesterday.
No, you said Hafez.
Hafez is the father who... Yes. Who we should mention back in 1982 murdered at least 10,000 members of the Muslim Brotherhood and destroyed the town of Hama with almost no notice in the outside world because this was generally approved. And the Hafez al-Assad's record toward the Palestinians is a mixed bag as well. I mean, that history is kind of forgotten, but you're of course aware of it. The strategic situation of Syria, of course, is far more significant than Libya, which other than oil offered really very little to the West. How do you see this playing out? We have Russia for example, which has bases in Syria, just sending its fleet into the Syrian port. How do you think this is going to play out internationally, and what role is Russia playing in this?
Yeah, there's no question that Syria is extremely important strategically for all the surrounding powers. And as is often the case when you have these popular uprisings, everybody wants to get a piece of the action. So Turkey, who has shifted from being a strong ally of Assad to being a very strong critic and is now hosting the Syrian National Council and the Free Syrian Army, I think it's called, the military group, are all based in Turkey. You mentioned Russia. China has its interests, and of course, the United States. The question, you know, Syria borders Israel, it borders Iraq, it borders Turkey, and so everybody wants a government friendly to themselves to emerge in Syria. And so far, no outside power has been able to do that, and there's no indication that they would. Once the dust settles and the new government comes to power, Syria still faces the problem that Israel occupies the Golan Heights, as it has since 1967. It's annexed it. There are Syrians still living inside Israel who maintain Syrian citizenship. That is an ongoing issue, and whoever comes to power in Syria is going to want to get the Golan back. There's no defined borders between Lebanon and Syria, believe it or not. There's a de facto border, but it never got officially recognized because of the history of French colonialism and the post-colonial era. That has to be resolved. Syria's oil supplies, et cetera, that has to be resolved. So each of the outside powers kind of wants to keep their thumb in the mix. So far, nobody is controlling things.
Now let's look at the role of the Arab League. They've sent a delegation there, which has been described by one of its members as a farce. A couple of its members' delegation were injured, and at least reported by the mainstream media, getting information from contacts in Syria, that the number of deaths per day have actually increased at the hands of the government since the Arab League delegation arrived.
Yeah, it's very difficult to figure out what's going on the ground because both sides exaggerate. The government certainly exaggerates the number of or underestimates the number of civilians killed, and the opposition, as reported in the U.S. media, tends to exaggerate as well. The Arab League, it was an unprecedented step. The Arab League had been kind of this quiescent group that periodically issued statements denouncing Israel or supporting various Arab countries, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't do a whole lot. Starting with the Libya intervention, which it initially endorsed, and now with this fact-finding commission, et cetera, it's playing a much more active role. It seems that neither side is very satisfied with what the Arab League is doing. The government has not embraced it and was only reluctantly allowing and is severely curtailing what they can do. And the demonstrators seem to think that their presence would actually, they could come in and stop the violence, which I think is a rather naive view given what the government is doing. So I think we're going to look back on it, and unless the Arab League issues a report strongly condemning the violence by the government, I think it's going to have not much of an impact either way. The repression and the fighting is continuing. A key thing to keep an eye on is supposedly the government is going to have parliamentary elections, free and fair parliamentary elections. It was going to be in February, now it's in March. Let's see if the elections take place, because I think the government would be very much on the losing side.
Would it be actually possible to hold elections in with such an atmosphere?
Well, it would be difficult. There's no question about it. But if they announced plans for free and fair elections and the opposition was convinced that they could participate, I think they would stop the violence. And then the government would be forced to confront that. I don't think, based on previous experiences in Syria and previous efforts at reform, it doesn't look like the government's going to allow the elections to take place.
Now, you mentioned the Free Syrian Army. We hear about defections from the Syrian army into the opposition. How widespread do you believe that is?
Well, it's much more than it used to be. In the beginning, one of the things that characterized the situation in Syria was that it was different from Tunisia or Egypt, where the military very quickly figured out that the former dictators there were more of a liability, cut them loose, and kept power for themselves. There have been no such indications from the high-ranking elements within the Syrian military. And that is a critical difference. That's one of the reasons the fighting has gone on for as long as it has. But there has been a trickle growing to more significant numbers of rank-and-file soldiers and lower-level officers defecting. Like I said, the Free Syrian Army tends to exaggerate their gains and et cetera, et cetera. But there's no—I mean, we've seen videos of very well-executed kind of guerrilla attacks on Syrian military and police, and the Syrian government certainly talks about it a lot. And there have been targeted assassinations of government supporters, and there have been targeted assassinations of opposition leaders. So it's, you know, there's been armed struggle going on in Syria pretty much from the beginning, and it's getting worse.
One thing is a new element recently came into the situation. This was bombing, suicide bombing, the style that we saw in Iraq, and where the government says it's Al-Qaeda and the opposition claims it's the government actually doing it,
right?
Which governments have been known to do. It certainly seems to play into the hands of the Assad regime to have an Al-Qaeda-like suicide bombing begin in Syria, which is designed to make the people think twice about their protests. What do you take on that?
It's very complicated. I don't have any inside information as to who is responsible. So far, nobody's claimed responsibility. There is no popular support for an Al-Qaeda-type group in Syria, and it's an easy label that the Syrian government makes, much like the Bush administration, or the Obama administration for that matter, likes to blame terrorists for everything that goes wrong, any criticism of U.S. policy, the terrorists must be behind it. So Assad does the same thing. There's a bombing in Damascus that killed a bunch of people. It looks suspicious because a lot of civilians were killed, and they didn't appear to be an immediate military target. That can be the earmark of a false flag operation where the government itself kills people in order for political purposes. Or it's conceivable that some extremists within the opposition movement carried it out, thinking that they were going to weaken the government by it. It's hard to know, and I suspect in the weeks ahead we may get more information on that.
One other thing we haven't got into. Iran, which has been a major supporter of Syria, has actually become relatively quiet, at least from what I've been able to find in terms of its support. And is even at one point, Ahmadinejad cautioned al-Assad. And yet, lately, I've seen, of course, Iran has its own problems, but it does not seem to be as enthusiastic a supporter publicly of Syria as it was, at least initially in the beginning of the protest.
Yeah, I think at the core, Iran remains allied with Syria and supportive of Assad, and they support the crackdown. They also have a plan B, like every other power in the region. If Assad falls, what kind of a government would come to power? And keep in mind that the alliance between Iran and Syria is not simply political, but there's very strong economic ties. There's a lot of religious tourism that comes to Syria, to various Shia shrines. It accounts for tens, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars a year. There's an auto factory and other investments by Iran in Syria. And, of course, militarily, they support Syria as well. So Iran, even if Assad falls, is looking at, well, who might come to power and how can we continue the alliance? So I think they're hedging their bets.
It's interesting. I haven't seen anything lately, but a few months ago, the U.S. obviously was not happy when the al-Maliki government in Iraq expressed support for al-Assad.
Right.
And that quickly dropped out of the newspapers. I haven't heard anything more about that, but I find that quite interesting. they always say, well, that's the Middle East, because it's been very...
When the U.S. can't control something, they go, oh, those crazy people in the Middle East.
My guess is Reese Ehrlich. Time is 9:47, and we open the phones to you. If any of you have questions or comments, the number here, of course, is 895-2448, 895-2448. It doesn't seem that this can continue on indefinitely the way it is, with the people on the ground opposing foreign intervention. And Assad, again, he gave a rally today, supposedly, and which was enthusiastically received. What is the prospect for the future?
When I was younger, of course, I could always accurately predict the future, and with age, I've learned that turns out it's not so easy. Revolution was going to take place in our lifetime, as I recall. But anyway, I don't know. The uprising and the government repression have gone on much longer than anybody could have predicted. It's been 10 months now. It started in March, and there's no signs of it letting up. The government is not strong enough to crush the opposition, and at least so far, the opposition is not strong enough to overthrow the government. Several things to keep an eye on. The economy and the economic situation is getting worse in Syria, both because of the disruption of the demonstrations and everything that entails, and now the foreign sanctions. So what happens with the economy may help tilt the balance of political forces, and the opposition seems to be having more military success in their armed attacks on the government. The government is trying to use that as a sign of how violent the opposition is. But people see on the ground if the police and the army can't protect them, they tend to shift sides. So I can't predict what exactly is going to happen, but. The fighting could go on for some time.
Well, we have the board lit up, so let's go to our first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Question. There seems to be an international game of chicken taking place in the Straits of Hormuz, and I'm especially concerned with apparently thousands of troops, American troops, out of Germany, are pouring into Israel, even as I speak. And what do you make of that? What's going to happen? Are we on the brink of World War III?
I don't think it's that serious.
I'm going to hang up.
It's not directly related to Syria, but I'm happy to comment on it. Yeah, the U.S. is sending troops to Israel for joint military actions with the Israelis. Some people have speculated that they would stay there permanently. That's not clear whether that would happen or not. There's certainly a lot of saber rattling, both from Iran and the United States, about the Straits of Hormuz, which, of course, is where about 20% of the world's oil supplies come through the very narrow waterway there between Iraq and Iran. I think what's happening is the U.S. Thinks that it can pressure an overthrow of the government in Iran, and that somehow a pro-U.S. government would emerge out of as a result. And yet they're not willing to bomb Iran or allow Israel to bomb Iran, because that would have huge consequences for the U.S. militarily, economically, politically in the region. So they've set tactics of cranking up sanctions, becoming more bellicose, et cetera, and Iran's response is to get bellicose back. And the danger in this situation is that somebody miscalculates and some incident takes place which kicks into real war. But I think right now the U.S. is carrying a big stick and trying to use the economic sanctions as a way to get rid of the government. And it's not going to work. What it's going to do is it's going to rally the people of Iran around their government and have the opposite effect. The people of Iran have opposed their government for a long time, but in the face of repression and these nationalistic calls, U.S. attacks on Iran have exactly the opposite effect.
Thanks for that. We have another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for your program. I'm wondering what military support the United States has customarily been giving to Syria, if any, and or any support that might be there for the insurgents, whether covert or overt, by military weapons producers.
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. has no history of giving arms to the Syrian government, if that was your question. Syria has always been on the other, with the exception of the Gulf War in 1990, where Syrians did contribute some forces to the so-called coalition efforts to attack and invade Iraq. Other than that, there hasn't been military cooperation. Is the U.S. providing arms or other support for the insurgents in Syria? I have not heard of such accounts. Is it possible? Sure. The U.S. does this in various places around the world. They'd love to have a pro-U.S. government come to power in Syria if they could do it. And I think they're working politically with some of the exiled leaders. But I've seen, at least so far, nothing has come to light about covert military activity in Syria.
Thanks for that call. We do know that the March 14th movement, the Sunni movement in Lebanon, headed by Rafiq Hariri, the son of Saeed Hariri, the son of Rafiq Hariri, is very much interested in a regime change in Syria, because he's trying to do whatever he can to weaken the strength of Hezbollah, and there are obviously alliances between the Lebanese Sunni, those Lebanese Sunni, and those in Syria, which are, I suspect, are being pushed by. Well, we've seen a recent article in Counterpunch about the neocon agenda in Syria. The irony being that the two countries that Israel has in its crosshair, so to speak, after Iraq, were Syria and Iran, and both of those are the most likely places where we may have some kind of a regime change or attempted regime change or fighting. Well, what's your comment on the role that the neocons have been playing in pushing the belligerent agenda towards Syria?
Yeah, just a quick comment. I don't know. Regime change may come quicker in Yemen, for example, than in Iran. So I wouldn't say that, you know, the neocons have been particularly successful. There's upheaval going on throughout the Arab world. Not to mention the Tunisia and Egypt, where the governments already have been replaced. But there's no question that the U.S. and the neocons in particular want to see pro-U.S. regimes in both Iran and Syria. They've harped on that issue for a long time, back during the Iraq War period. Some neocons were arguing for a military strike against Iran rather than Iraq, because they thought that was a bigger enemy. And in any case, Iraq was going to be the first victory, and then we roll on through to regime change in Syria and Iran. That was explicitly talked about. The fact that they talk about it and want it doesn't mean that they're actually controlling the situation. I remember reading some neocon columnists at the time of the Iranian uprising in 2009 saying that, you know, the Iranian people were rising up against Islamofascism, a term that I've never heard anybody use in the Middle East. They like to take credit for everything. They took credit for Tahrir Square. I mean, these guys have no shame. You know, if you actually go out and talk to the people in Tahrir Square, as I have in my reporting, or the people of Damascus, or the people in Iran, they hate U.S. policy. They hate the neocons the worst. Bush is, you know, I can speak three words of Arabic. It's down, down Bush. You know, it's like that's the predominant sentiment. So the neocons are simply out of whack with the reality.
Well, you mentioned Yemen, which doesn't get as much attention, but Yemen, the U.S. has been conducting a quote-unquote low-intensity drone war, and some more than drone war there, even as the ongoing struggle to oust an American ally goes on. And,
yes. The U.S. has this enormous double standard, which is in Syria they call for the overthrow, they want to change the entire system. In Yemen, where you have a pro-U.S. dictator who's been in power for 30 years, who is far more repressive, actually, than anything in the other camp, they want to kind of ease him out of power and make a transition so that the U.S. policies and a pro-U.S. government stays in power in Yemen, and same in Bahrain, for that matter. So U.S. is a huge double standard and a hypocritical policies.
Agreed. Reese Ehrlich, my guest, any last word? I want to mention your article on the Progressive in the December-January issue is now still on the newsstands, and I advise you to get that. But any last word for the listeners?
Sometimes people get a little discouraged or cynical about the popular struggles. 2011 should change a lot of that. We had the Arab Spring, we had the occupation in Madison, Wisconsin, and then the Occupy Wall Street. All of them have taken inspiration from each other. There really is a very, very significant movement going on worldwide. Get out there and do something about it.
Well, thank you very much. My guest today, again, Reese Ehrlich. Thanks very much, Reese, for being, as I say, a guest on Takes on the World, and keep on the good reporting.
Thank you.
Take care.